Welcome to another edition of Conversations with Creative Women. I'm Sandy Klein, an investigative journalist, documentary filmmaker, and former TV news executive. Sevilla Tamarkin is one socially committed, passionate, creative woman. And she has a slew of honors to prove it, including a National News and Documentary Emmy, an Edward R. Murrow Award, and numerous accolades from the Society of Professional Journalists and the Overseas Press Club. In more than 30 years as a journalist, much of Sevilla's focus was criminal and social injustice. While working at CNN, she was the executive producer of its Emmy Award-winning weekly show, CNN in Time. She's also produced investigative segments and series for ABC's World News Tonight, along with half-hour specials for Nightline, and has contributed to the network's coverage of major stories. Her investigative reports led to one of the first exculpatory DNA exonerations in the U.S., as well as the exoneration of a death row inmate. She's covered stories in Central America, Africa, India, Southeast Asia, including the fall of Vietnam and its aftermath for various newspapers and magazines. Closer to home, Sevilla happens to be the director, and along with Lucina Fisher, the writers of Birthright, a War Story. The feature-length documentary tells the story of women who have become collateral damage in the, quote, aggressive campaign to take control of reproductive health care and to allow states, courts, and religious doctrine to govern whether, when, and how women will bear children. Sevilla, welcome, and thanks so much for joining me today.
Thank you for having me here.
You know, that's a lot to chew on. Growing up, what drew you to journalism? Was it an obvious career path?
I never had any doubt that I wanted to be a writer. And I became very socially active in the 60s and concerned with the issues of the 60s, from anti-Vietnam to civil rights to women's rights, and decided that for me, the route to go was a journalist. I debated between law or journalism, but since my passion had always been writing and words, I thought I could be most effective.
And you wanted to, at the very least, document what you were seeing and what was going on in the world.
Exactly. I wanted to chronicle events as they were happening, which is, in effect, creating the record of history.
Mm.
I also wanted to be involved in social justice and criminal justice issues. And, you know, like any idealistic young person of the 60s, I thought I was going to change the world that way.
Didn't we all? Where did you go to school?
I went to school. I grew up in Chicago, and I went to public high schools in Chicago, and then I went to the University of Illinois.
Mm-hmm. What was that like, becoming a journalist and being female back then?
Well, we had some very admirable role models, like Marguerite Higgins, mm-hmm. who had won the Pulitzer in the Korean War and covered World War II. But for the most part, everybody in my family tried to dissuade me.
Because why? This was not a woman's field?
This was not something you did. You know, you went, and in fact, I did get credentialed enough to get a degree in education, and I started out right out of college teaching journalism in English in high school, running the high school newspaper as advisor and the high school yearbook. And I was doing this in a small town in Michigan, Benton Harbor, Michigan. And I remember that this was 1968.
All right.
The county, Berrien County, voted for George Wallace. So I was...
You had your work cut out for you,
exactly.
Didn't you?
Uh-huh. It was an anathema to, you know, and I certainly was an oddity there. So I do remember that the principal of the high school came to me one day and said, "We have to cut back the funding for the school paper." I said, "Why?" He said, "Because we need new football uniforms, and you know that the football field is where we prepare our young men for battlefield."
Wow. So you were out.
We managed to raise resources and, you know, the usual things that high school kids do to raise money.
Mm-hmm. Comedy bake sales, huh?
And car washes.
and car washes, right.
But it was an interesting time because I chose to begin the sort of social action there. So as an English teacher, we held some anti-war literary events where students would get up and read poems that were against war, against killing, etc. And
how did that fly in that community?
It didn't.
I would think not.
You know, I was driving to the high school one day, and on the local radio station, there was an editorial calling for my resignation.
No kidding.
And I had to go before the school board and the superintendent.
Because you were
conducting anti-American activities.
Okay. You were a heathen.
I remember writing an editorial in the local paper at the time saying that, you know, Sacco Vanzetti is alive and well and living in Benton Harbor, Michigan.
Uh-huh. So what was that like for you as a very young woman?
It was very short-lived. I went back to Chicago.
Take us on your professional journey.
Well, then I became a playwright.
Oh, my goodness. I didn't know that.
I was in Chicago. I wrote and had two plays produced. I was doing that, and I went back to grad school at the same time. And I had a child, and my daughter. And I remember it was very exciting because I gave birth to her. And then 2 weeks later, my first play opened.
Wow. Was, you know, so you had two births.
Two births.
Uh-huh.
Two births. And then I went back to graduate school and started freelancing for the Chicago newspapers, doing book reviews and lyric criticism. That was the time of, this was the early 70s. And so I would write several articles about women's literature and the rise of feminist literature. And then I got divorced and was with a new partner, and he was a correspondent for the Chicago Daily News at that time, and he had an assignment to go to Vietnam. So I lined up my own assignments.
And you went with him?
I met him there.
No kidding.
With my four-year-old in tow.
No, oh, that in and of itself is unheard of. You went to Vietnam in the early 70s with your child on assignment.
I did, on freelance assignments.
And how long were you there?
I was unfortunately only there a brief time because by the time I came, Vietnam was falling. And I was freelancing and writing wherever I could. Interesting, there were orphan lifts to get out the Vietnamese
children
right before Saigon fell. And there was an attempt to, you know, have military planes. They couldn't get them. So they had a C-10 had crashed with all the orphans.
Oh, my God.
But prior to that, all the orphans were being sequestered in a convent waiting for the flight to come in. All the journalists were pounding on the gates, on the wire gates of the convent to try to get in and take pictures and interview the children. And finally, one of the nuns reached over to me as I was on the journalist side and said, "Do you know how to change diapers?" I said, "Do I ever?" And she opened the gate. I got in there. I got to know these children. I got to, know the caregivers. And then tragically, that flight crashed.
Oh, my gosh. Oh, my gosh. So with your daughter in tow and you're filing stories, and then you come back before your husband does?
No, I left Vietnam shortly before the fall because I got out on one last flight to take my daughter.
It was dangerous.
I thought I would leave her with friends in Hong Kong and be able to get back in. But Tan Son Nhut had been bombed, so I could not get in.
And so then what happened to you?
I remained in Hong Kong writing about the fall from my perspective for some literary magazines. Mm-hmm. And my husband at the time was one of the last foreign correspondents out.
Wow.
I thought he was staying behind, but he got on the last lift after Ambassador Gray Martin had fled, and two Marines grabbed him by the arm and said, we're not leaving an American
you're coming with us. Yeah. Right.
So then we lived in Asia for a while. We were in Hong Kong briefly. Then we lived in Bangkok covering the aftermath of Indochina, and we moved to India. We were in Africa and, you know, went to Burma, went to all the countries, but we were based in Bangkok and in Africa after that.
Kind of begs the question, how come no one's made a film about you?
Well, you know, that's one of the things that we always say. Everybody who writes says, I'm going to do my own memoir. Mm-hmm. So, you know, it's the pages sit in the drawer as I get diverted by other projects.
Well, get undiverted because you've got tales to tell. So just kind of move us along.
Back in the States, I began to work as a journalist. Mm-hmm. I walked in and got
a job. We had tremendous street cred.
Got a job in the Chicago Bureau at Time Magazine as a freelance contributor and began covering this was 79, I guess, and began covering the politics and education and the Reagan campaign and moved on from Time. Actually, I did a very interesting story there because I had then enrolled my daughter and I was determined to have her attend public schools. Mm-hmm. And I was shocked at what was happening in the public schools. And I was very dismayed by the kinds of mimeographed in those days assignments she was bringing home. And finally, one of the teachers said to me, you know, I think you should consider private school. I don't think we can.
This is not working out.
This is not working out. Uh-huh. She's being, you know, not being challenged. I went to the bureau chief of Time, and I said, I think there's a story here. What's happening? I mean, as someone who had had some years in education.
Sure.
And so while I was out on the campaign trail for the 1980 election, pre-election, he said, feel free to look into educational issues, too. The result of that was a breakthrough Time magazine cover called Help Teacher Can't Teach.
Wow.
And
wow.
It showed all of the demands made on teachers so that actually teaching in the classroom was
challenging.
The most challenging part.
Uh-huh.
And then I remained with Time as a freelance contributor. I moved on to People magazine. Mm-hmm. I did assignments. I was with People magazine for 11 years, which I tell people was a bit of an oxymoron because I did a lot of investigative reporting for People.
Who would have thunk, you know?
Well, in those days, People was not the celebrity magazine it became. The concept was people behind the news.
Yeah.
So I covered the drought, dealing with the death of American small farms. I covered child abuse cases.
So were you on the road for them?
I was on the road often with stories. Absolutely.
So basically, the written word was your thing.
It was.
When did that morph into the visual?
One year, this childhood friend, Rick Kaplan, who had become an executive at ABC, and I were both getting Overseas Press Club Awards, which, again, was most unusual for People magazine. But
you're right. That does seem oxymoron-ish.
Mm-hmm. And we reconnected, and he said, I want you to come and do investigations at ABC. And I said, I don't know television.
Exactly.
He said,
yes. Doesn't matter.
You're a journalist. You're an investigator. I can teach you television. And the visual medium worked very well for me because when I was at People, the People concept was very similar like the old Life magazine. The words and the pictures had to go together. So mm-hmm. I had a photographer mm-hmm. partner with me all the time. Mm-hmm. And I was always the backseat driver saying, let's grab that. Let's do that image. Let's do tighter frame on that. So the visual seemed to come to me naturally. In terms of storytelling, it just worked. And I had a wonderful, wonderful opportunity with ABC to do long investigations for them. 3-4-5-part series.
Wow. Did you become a full-time ABC employee?
No, I was on contract. And we did a lot of breakthrough work. I mean,
did you come up with a lot of the stories?
They were my stories.
They were yours.
But
well.
I also participated in breaking news stories.
Okay.
At that time,
mm-hmm.
the Oklahoma bombing, certainly.
Sure. Uh-huh.
JonBenet Ramsey case. I mean, everybody was on deck when those kinds of things happened. But I came up with my own investigative series and worked with a wonderful correspondent, Aaron Hayes, at the time. And we made a lot of breakthrough. I mean, one series that went on for days. I mean, and we were very lucky to get significant chunk of time. Out of a 22-minute broadcast, we'd get 7 minutes.
That's huge. So you were the researcher, the writer, the producer. Did you want to be on camera?
No.
Okay, because when you were working with print, your you know, you're the chief cook and bottle washer,
right.
You know, and no. That's an interesting.
No, but we were a wonderful team. Often wrote together. Mm-hmm. Sometimes she wrote it because she was delivering the words. Then we also had a field producer who worked with us, who was teaching me the visuals. And
which you said was in a sense a natural act.
Yeah, to me, I mean, I could see where the pictures worked.
So then, did something in your brain tell you in terms of what your professional next step was?
So then, I liked working with, you know, the imagery and the words, and I liked the impact that broadcast journalism could have.
Sure.
And we had a lot of breakthroughs, including work that helped exonerate someone from death row and prove that one of the street gangs that was masquerading as a political action committee was actually giving money to various Illinois politicians laundering drug money. We showed how poultry industry was bringing in, smuggling in. We followed a truck, a bus actually, of illegal workers that were being smuggled in because they were a disposable workforce. Because if they were injured on the lines of the poultry plant as these knives were flying,
good God,
they were disposable. Their accidents were not reported to OSHA.
Wow.
They were not given the medical care. So we did some you know, significant work.
Impactful stories, yeah.
And then Rick Kaplan, who had been running World News and mm-hmm. brought me aboard, went on to become president of CNN.
And clearly he was taking you with him, huh?
So I went. Uh-huh. I went. I left Chicago. I moved to Atlanta. So
and you became what?
I started there as a senior producer doing investigations. And then there was an unfortunate release of a story prematurely. It was called Tailwind. And it was a story that premised to state that America had dropped nerve gas in Laos.
Mm.
And there were problems apparently with subjects who recanted later and changed their stories
story.
And so on. It became very controversial. And so this aired on a show that was a breakthrough show. It was called CNN in Time. It was the convergence, if you will, of print and broadcast mm-hmm. because Time Warner had bought
CNN. Mm-hmm.
And so it was an attempt to utilize the resources of print and
cross-pollinate. And, yeah, right. Cross-pollinate, right.
And there had always been, you know, somewhat of a distrust between print and television news.
Everybody was very proprietary, probably.
And this story was quite a source of frustration. I then, because I had the print background and because I had worked within the Time Inc. structure,
mm-hmm.
I was asked to take over this show mm-hmm. and try to keep the print people aboard and interested and to also, you know, keep this weekly news magazine, which was very much like a 60 Minutes
gotcha.
Type, keep it afloat. And so I did. It was very difficult to get people. I was, you know, the ABC people at that time, the management group that Rick brought in, we were looked upon as, you know, the New York carpetbaggers, even though I wasn't from New York.
Right.
Because CNN was a very insular culture at the time.
Mm-hmm.
But we managed to get a lot done and change, Rick Kaplan changed CNN.
And you were part of that change.
And we were part of it in, you know, those days. And this show went on to win Emmys. And I remember that all the other magazine shows knew the frustration we had and the difficult time we had, you know, being reborn. And I remember when we won an Emmy the following year, you know, the 60 Minutes table stood up and the 2020s table stood up and everybody understood.
You got your props, huh?
What we had gone through.
Mm.
So that was a wonderful experience. And it was at a time where I remember keeping changes of clothing in my file drawers and going down to the gym to shower in the morning because there were plenty of all-nighters. Those
yeah.
were the days of the Kosovo War, of impeachment, of John Kennedy Jr.'s plane going down.
Mm.
So it was a heavy, heavy news cycle. Even when I was running a magazine, weekly magazine show, we then pitched in on the news cycle and we would do our specials. So it was quite heavy.
I'm exhausted. Was Birthright your first film?
No. No. So to quickly catch up, when I left CNN on the heels of the AOL merger, mm-hmm. I started my own production company and began to do documentaries. And I had wonderful opportunity to do three documentaries for ESPN Original Entertainment. One was on the Republican attempt to roll back Title IX. And I did one about drugs and sports, which predated, you know, all the controversy mm-hmm. about it. And I did a fabulous, again, tying to my timing roots, I did a two-hour history of Sports Illustrated magazine, which in effect was the history of sports from Black African-American involvement in sports mm-hmm. to women's involvement in sports. And so it was...
What a chronicler you are!
Wonderful opportunity. And then what happened is I had been widowed while I was at CNN. In 2004, I reconnected with someone I had gone to high school with who had been a widower. Mm-hmm. And we got together. And I moved to... Phoenix, Arizona, Scottsdale area, Carefree actually is the small town
outside. What's in a name, yeah. Mm-hmm.
And decided I was going to do an independent film. So I did. I did an independent documentary about a family who's from Green Bay, Wisconsin, whose son was one of the first casualties of the Iraqi war after President Bush stood aboard the
destroyer
and mm-hmm. said, you know, this is an end to all hostilities.
Right, right.
I did that, and we made Tribeca Film Festival.
Oh, great.
And, but it was a self-funded independent film. It was after all the years of working for organizations or even as an independent doing something for ESPN, this was a chance for me to just express myself. And I did, and it didn't really go anywhere. I think it's out in the VOD world. But I then decided to go to this memoir that I mentioned to just sort of semi-retire. And in June of 2014, the Hobby Lobby decision came down. That was a Supreme Court decision that said this private employer, the retail Hobby Lobby stores, mm-hmm. could deny contraceptive access on its health insurance
for its
employees.
Yeah.
And this was based upon the owner's religious beliefs.
Beliefs, yeah.
It paved the way for all the bans we are now seeing about contraceptive coverage under insurance and Medicaid even. There's an attempt now to limit that. I was outraged. As someone who was a product of the 60s, mm-hmm. as someone who had fought for women's rights, I was stunned. I was appalled. How did this happen? And where are the women? Mm-hmm. Why are women still shopping at Hobby Lobby? Why aren't there boycotts in front of this retail chain? And I was encouraged by a number of friends. I was in Chicago that time over the summer visiting with friends, and I still maintain a residence there. And they said, knowing your background, you've got to do something. The question was, what? What approach do you take? And as a journalist, I have always tried to connect the dots. And so as I was struggling to discover how did this decision come down, what was the mechanism that brought it to play, I began this odyssey of trying to put together all the pieces to where we are now with the assault on women's reproductive health. And I began researching and I began investigating and talking to all the experts in the field and experts on both sides of the issue, advocates rather on both sides of the issue, victims, et cetera. And I drew in a friend and former colleague from Time Inc. days, Lucina Fisher, who is a different generation than I am. She's younger than I am, and it was a good match.
Your movie, Birthright, the focus always seems to have been on abortion and a woman's right to choose. And there have been, documentaries, the wonderful documentary Trapped, whatever. It's as if this issue of reproductive rights on another level got pushed to the side.
Well, I think that abortion became the focus.
Right.
And the jargon focused on abortion, pro-choice, for example.
Right.
And as we say often in discussing the film, what I was interested in was the ripple effect, the fallout. The war initially started with, does a woman have the right to have an abortion? But what I was seeing vis-a-vis the Hobby Lobby decision is that there was so much that was happening way beyond that singular issue.
Exactly. That's exact. That it had legs in a very different way.
Exactly. I mean, it was almost like an atomic bomb that, you know, you began to see how far this fallout radiation, if you will.
I bet you were overwhelmed by that.
And I was shocked. And I think what was most interesting to me was the notion, myself included, we had won.
Yeah, I don't have a problem getting contraception, you know, kind of thing. Yeah.
We won contraception.
The naivete of it all. Or
exactly. I mean, the Griswold versus Connecticut decision in 1965 gave people the right to use contraceptives. The court decided it was a private matter, even though heretofore it had been considered immoral. But we had the right to use contraception. We had the right to decide whether or not we wanted a medical procedure, i.e. an abortion.
Right.
And so the success with that, of course, is if you control a woman's reproduction, you control a woman's life.
Exactly.
And once you can control your own as a woman, you have opportunities for economic advancement, educational, a wide range of
opportunity
in front of you.
Yeah.
So it's not surprising that we all had lost sight of the fact that while we were moving beyond the issue of bodily rights, if you will, that the opposition had slowly been building its war machine.
Yes, and mobilizing.
Strategizing.
Yeah.
Infiltrating the Republican Party, forming alliances, and the Republican Party, in turn, saw the opportunity, particularly when the evangelical movement with Jerry Falwell and the Moral Majority came aboard because they saw how the Republican Party could widen their tent.
Mm-hmm.
With the resources and the money from the right-wing religious groups. So it all made very strange bedfellows, you know, including the religious rights support of Donald Trump today. But they very craftily managed to get people elected to office. They recruited candidates who would be loyal, who would then pay back the support. And little by little, they began to take over state legislatures. And when the Tea Party rose, it initially began as, at least most people thought, it was an economic, a party that was dealing with economic issues. The minute they got into office in 2010, in the midterm elections that were a backlash against Obama, it became very clear that restricting abortion was a priority as well.
I can't imagine what this process of getting all this information, also kind of expanding your view of all of this, you know, unbeknownst to you, you know, as you're uncovering layer after layer after layer, what that must have been like in putting this film together. Was this something that when you started out, you had no idea where you were going when you ended?
Correct. The only thing I knew when I started out was that there was a younger generation of women that were unaware, for the most part, of what was happening. And there was an older generation, like myself, that had become complacent.
I agree. I'm in part of that generation. Absolutely. It was just a given. I never had to think twice about it.
No, we did not. And my daughter's generation, the next generation, benefited from those opportunities.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm talking about a generation that includes my granddaughters now. Unaware.
So how long did it take you to make this film?
From the moment
Inception.
That I, you know, from
conception?
From the conception till the release, 3 years.
Wow.
It's 3 years.
And you just traveled around the country?
We talked to people around the country, certainly not always with a camera. Phones, thank goodness. Skype, thank goodness.
Of course.
But we communicated with people all across the country.
What'd you learn?
What I learned was that this war machine, if you will, had been building for decades and decades and decades. And I remember giving a talk to a group of professors and medical professionals while I was still in production. And I said, someone compared it to the rise of the Weimar Republic when everybody was celebrating, you know, the Roaring Twenties and the victory of World War One. Here, the opposition was building.
Building, exactly.
One of the most frightening things was how young women were unaware of what was happening. But meanwhile, in the anti-abortion movement, they had been training a youth corps
to go out into the
field 30 or more years through church camps and programs that taught them all about the evils of abortion. And they were, you know, in religious indoctrination camps that stressed life begins at conception, the moment that the egg is fertilized.
End of discussion.
And the problem with that is that they have created their own, quote, junk science, if you will. And I don't use the term loosely because we took their findings and ran them past people at the executive director of the American College of Obstetrics and Gynecology. We ran them past public health physicians and, you know, medical practitioners. But they took their studies and their beliefs and came up with the fact that contraceptives, certain contraceptives, not condoms, but the IUD, the birth control pill, anything that prevents a fertilized egg from making its way up the birth canal, vaginal canal, and implanting into the uterine wall is a form of abortion, and they call them abortifacients.
Oh, gosh.
So what's so fascinating is that the Republican Party had never opposed contraceptives, because if you're opposed to abortion, then you want to promote contraception and family planning.
Precisely, right.
And George H.W. Bush, 41, President 41, had been one of the sponsors and supporters of family planning bills that evolved under President Nixon as Title 10. Ironically, this was shocking for me to discover that President Bush's father, Prescott Bush, W's grandfather, had been one of the original board members and officers of Planned Parenthood.
Whoa.
With Margaret Sanger.
Wow. Is that crazy?
So these are the compromises that a lot of Republicans made, even opposing contraception today.
Mm-hmm. Where is this film today? I mean, in terms of its reception, who's seeing it?
Well, we're trying to reach out to every woman. We do not want this film to be a film that is only seen by the choir.
Yeah.
You know, we
right.
do not want to preach to the choir.
Exactly.
The purpose of this film was to show every woman, regardless of her view on abortion, regardless of her political leanings, that the rhetoric, the ideology, and the legislation that is evolving from that can ensnare her, and she too can be a victim.
Unbeknownst to so many women.
Exactly.
So this film is not so much political as it is educational.
It's educational. We hope it will be a call to action.
Mm-hmm.
We hope that will be a wake up for all women, for the men who care about them, to realize that their lives are in jeopardy, their families are in jeopardy. I mean, a woman who is pregnant with a much wanted pregnancy and wants to have natural childbirth at home may not be allowed to do it if her physician decides that he wants to get a court order for a cesarean, as has been the case.
Ay vey.
Situations where women's behavior becomes suspect. A woman in Iowa fell down the stairs while pregnant. She went to the emergency room to make sure that her fetus was all right.
What, they think she was trying to self-abort?
Well, she was suspected of it, and they called in the authorities.
Unbelievable.
And this is what happens in countries.
Where are we, Nazi Germany?
Well, this is what happens in countries where abortion is illegal. In Mexico, in Central America, in El Salvador, women are in jail. A woman recently who was raped and gave birth to had a stillbirth, was just sentenced to 30 years in jail because the courts were not convinced that it was a stillbirth that she had not induced.
This film should be everywhere, shouldn't it?
We hope it is. We hope that it gets out there, that people will ask their local theaters to show it. We'll
get to festivals, get to schools, right?
Everywhere. We do have, I mean, if I can get a little plug in, we have a website up.
Of course.
It's birthrightfilm.com. And on that website, there is a sign-up sheet. You can request to have screenings in your community, at your YWCA, in your church groups, in your community groups. We want everybody, regardless of their religious views, to see this, because a woman may be miscarrying. Again, a much-wanted pregnancy, and hemorrhaging, becoming infected, as we portray in the film, and wind up in the emergency room of a Catholic hospital where she may not immediately receive the treatment she needs because there still is a faint fetal heartbeat. So this affects every woman, regardless of her views.
You take my breath away. Thank you for doing this.
Thank you for allowing me to discuss the issues with you.
I hope there's a lot more going on in your future.
Well, thank you. But I hope there's a much younger generation to pick up the mantle.
we learn from you. I can't thank you enough for joining me today. Birthrightfilm.com is the website. Go to the website.
Yes.
Thank you again. Wow.
Thank you.
Join us for another edition of Conversations with Creative Women. I'm Sandy Klein.